Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Estás escuchando The Fifth Floor.
The Fifth Floor'ı dinliyorsunuz. Bizimle kalın.
Dünya ekte The Fifth Floor farnak amidi sobat.
This is The Fifth Floor, at the heart of global storytelling with BBC journalists from all around the world. I'm your host, Farnak Amidi. Before the war started, Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine was known as the city of wine and roses. The local winery was among the biggest producers of sparkling wine in the country. And then there was Rose Alley, a street with a flower display that had 5,000 roses in it. Bakhmut was also the home of the National Music Academy of Ukraine. But Bakhmut is no more. In August 2022, Russian forces began a ferocious attack on the city.
Armata! Острил!
For months now, the city of Bakhmut has been the epicenter of the war in Ukraine. The battle there has been one of the most brutal of the conflict, with high numbers
of... On the side of the road, you can see apartment blocks that are completely destroyed. We're walking all over shards of glass. Pretty much every second you hear the sound of artillery fire.
As death and destruction mounted, most of Bakhmut's people fled, leaving behind what one Ukrainian commander recently described as utter hell.
The fight to take Bakhmut lasted over 10 months and claimed the lives of thousands of people on both sides, becoming the longest and bloodiest battle in this war so far. What really happened in Bakhmut, and why was it so important to Russia? Olga Ivshina from BBC Russian has spent the past year trying to figure this out. Olga is here in the Fifth Floor studio with me. Olga, welcome.
Thank you.
And Vitaly Shevchenko is also with us. He's been reporting on Bakhmut for Ukraine Cast, the podcast he co-presents.
Hello, Franek. Оля, привет.
So, Vitaly, I'm going to start with you. You have a special connection with Bakhmut. Tell me more about it. How was life there before the war? And what was the city like?
You know, I never thought we'd going to be talking about Bakhmut on the BBC, because I grew up knowing that it's a small, sleepy, leafy town where hardly anything ever happens. My grandfather is from Bakhmut, and that's where he met my grandmother. So I have these black and white pictures of them, very young, about to get married, obviously in love. And to me, Bakhmut, or Artemivsk, as it was called back then, it was this place of quiet and coziness. I have to say, I've never been there myself, but I've heard plenty of stories from them and from my mother. And if I were to choose a word that summarizes it, I would use the word cozy.
Olga, Bakhmut is in eastern Ukraine, in the Donbass region. Was that the reason that it became a target?
It's a good question. You know, I have been to Bakhmut very briefly in 2014 when I was covering the first phase of war in Ukraine. But back then, yeah, I agree with Vitaly. It felt like sleepy town. I mean, back then it was already a bit of tension there, but it was considered safe compared to the places we used to go, because it was like 40, 50 kilometers away from the front line, the main evacuation point, the place where you would see a lot of wounded Ukrainian soldiers. Because the main fighting was going on around Donetsk, in 2014, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk. So Bakhmut was considered to be far away from war. So, yeah, I agree. You know, it was really hard to understand that this was real, the fighting for Bakhmut, which went on for months and months and months. Bakhmut is an interesting place strategically. On the one hand, it's not the best strategic point. There are cities and towns and hills which seem to make more sense strategically. But it seems to be a coincidence of factors that Russians decided to go for Bakhmut. Actually, one of them being the Russia was having really hard times on the other parts of the front line. And in order to distract attention, both in the media sphere and militarily from other parts, they decided to continue this assault on Bakhmut and eventually take the city. But what was going on, you know, in a way, things and objectives were changing as the battle developed.
And Olga, the attack on Bakhmut started in August 2022, but as you mentioned, it went on for months, actually 10 months. Why did this battle take so long? And why was it so important for the Russians to take Bakhmut?
There are different versions on when exactly the battle for Bakhmut has started, because it depends on how you define the region. You know, the first fights in Bakhmut area were already going on in July 2022. It seems that at first they were just trying to, you know, one of the Russians' objectives was to get to Slavyansk, because it's strategically it is a very important point. And also from the PR perspective, Slavyansk is important because that's where the Russian-backed separatists and former and acting special forces Russian officers started their military actions in Ukraine in 2014. And in a way, in the eyes of public, Slavyansk has become a symbol of that fighting. And also strategically, it sits in the place where a few important roads come together. So this is a good place. But in order to get to Slavyansk, in a way, you need to pass Bakhmut. But as I said, you know, while the battle for Bakhmut was developing, it seems at some point they saw that there is no way they're going to get to Slavyansk. So what some military experts told me, they decided to stay in Bakhmut in order to distract attention, first of all, and secondly, to continue a fight with Ukraine in order to drench as much as Ukrainian troops as possible. And we will see
exhaust them,
make Ukrainians spend a lot of armor and send their best soldiers to that position. And we see how this tactics was evolving.
Vitaly, why was it so important for Ukrainians to defend Bakhmut for so long?
Well, why is it important to defend yourself? It's pretty clear that nobody wants to retreat for any, you know, for no reason at all. And the Ukrainians have been saying all along that they're determined to fight for every single inch of their land. And that fight, of course, it comes at a cost, at a human cost. And as Russians have been making progress across eastern Donbass region, of course, questions are being asked within Ukraine. You know, the approach that Russians take to capturing towns and cities is very often by leveling them to the ground, by completely razing them. So the questions that are being asked in Ukraine are along the lines of, okay, are the lives of our soldiers worth the ruins that are left after the incessant bombardment and shelling by Russian forces that we're, you know, fighting over? So on the one hand, of course, Ukrainians are fighting for their land and for their towns and cities. On the other hand, do these buildings, this land, is it all worth human lives? And it's a very fundamental existential question. Now, there's also the question of how these towns and cities, how they help further advances by the Russians. So right now, we've been talking about places like Pokrovsk and Chasiv Yar, and I really doubt that we'd be talking about them and their possible capture by the Russians had they not captured places like Bakhmut. So it's a step-by-step military approach, and you can't really jump to places further west without capturing places in the east.
And do we know how many civilians died in Bakhmut?
Not precisely. All we've got are figures reported by local officials, such as the mayor of Bakhmut, Alexei Reva, who said after the battle was over that 204 civilians had been killed. But in the chaos of war, it's not so easy to count every single death or casualty.
And we know that both sides are quite hesitant about giving exact numbers of their casualties. Olga, you're part of a wider BBCM Media Zona project that you are counting and identifying the soldiers that have died on the Russian side. And Olga, when you look at those who died in Bakhmut on the Russian side, you found out that a lot of them were prisoners that were recruited through this project called Project K. Tell me more about it.
Yes, so when we talk about Bakhmut, it's also important to say that it was advanced by the Russian forces, but back then, an important part of Russian forces was so-called Wagner, this shadow military entity, which is close to Kremlin, but not directly related to Kremlin. So they used to use them for specific tasks when you want to achieve your goal, but want to have zero relation to that.
When keep your hands clean, kind of.
Sort of. So it's important to know that the fighting for Bakhmut on the Russian side was mostly done by Wagner troops. And also, once again, you know, because it's all connected, it was a very important PR step for Prigozhin, the founder of Wagner. He wanted to show that he's effective. Before the invasion, Wagner was a pretty small group. So in late June 2022, he got a permission from Moscow to start massive recruitment in the Russian prisons. And he started using a helicopter, just going from one prison to another. The whole prison was waiting for him in the sort of this central prison square, all lined up. He made a speech. And because Prigozhin himself is a former criminal, he spent, I think, like 10 years in the Soviet prison. He knows how to talk to these guys. So very quickly, he started to recruit people. And the deal was, if you survive 6 months with us on the front line, you're free. You get a presidential pardon. You're a hero suddenly instead of being an ex-convict. And
that's
also
a very attractive initiative.
It is. And he knows how to do these speeches. And also, at first, he aimed at people who were serving terms for double murders, very violent guys. Wagner started to use them to advance. And this year, we got some documents. A source gave us documents about all so-called coffin payments. So if you are killed on the front line with Wagner, you get your family or whoever you assign, they get a compensation. So we got those documents for that exact period of time, for the Battle of Bakhmut.
And is that a considerable amount of compensation?
It's 5 million rubles, which makes it, I think, around 50,000 pounds, sort of, probably $60,000, if I'm correct. So, yeah, it's a huge money in Russia, huge money, especially even bigger money for you know, prisoners. And people started to sign up. So these documents we got, what they had, it's very important. So when any Wagner member, but especially prisoners, when they were joining in, each of them was giving a code, a dog tag. And the dog tag consisted of a letter and the six numbers. The letter shows whether you are convict, and it started with K, letter K, because in K in Russian stands for colonia, prison colony. And then six other letters. First three letters is a code name for prison in which you were recruited. And the last three digits shows your number of recruitment in that prison. So by having dog tags, we can figure out, first of all, how many people were recruited and also how many dead and how many survived.
Mm. And when you looked into how these soldiers were killed, what did you find out?
Those coffin payments, when you analyze them, they tell you the whole story. So first of all, when Prigozhin was recruiting those prisoners, he was always claiming we'll treat you as equals. But we found out that this statement was false. So if you look at the number of people recruited and killed, so the total number of Wagner staff members killed fighting for Bakhmut is almost 20,000 killed in action. From those 20,000 killed, over 17,000 of them were prisoners. And also then, analyzing the death dates, we see how it developed. So first, they only recruited seasoned inmates, so to say, those who maybe...
Very violent.
Yeah, very violent. And those were trained well. They got 2-3 weeks of training. But then it seems that the tactic has changed. They decided to keep going at Bakhmut no matter what. So they needed more and more people. So they lowered the bar. They started to recruit people from different walks of life. So in the end, they were even recruiting people from prison hospitals. There were special units created only from people with HIV, with hepatitis. Prigozhin was taking them all. And also we see that at the beginning where they were trying to use them wisely, but then it seems, you know, he was losing up to 200 people per day, 90% of them sometimes being prisoners. And if you talk to survivors of the battle on both sides, they all say the discipline in Wagner was very strict. You had a task. If you don't deliver, you are killed on the spot. So prisoners were tasked to go towards Ukrainian positions to provoke Ukrainians' open fire. And when Ukrainians opened fire, yes, those, you know, 5-10 people were dead or severely injured. But, okay, now the main Wagner units know exactly where positions are and know which position is which, because there are positions where there are just people with Kalashnikovs, with a machine gun, etc., etc. So they could make a precision strikes with the drones, with artillery. So it's a very brutal tactic. Like one Ukrainian soldier told BBC, immoral, but very effective. It costs you a lot of lives. But if you don't care about lives, it's very effective because you can do those precision strikes and, you know, you would push Ukrainians backwards because they have to retreat. Otherwise, they'll lose all their troops. While Wagner was sending those prisoners to fight, so in a way, this was a cheap fighting force. If you send them against people who were trained really well, you are using low-cost troops to get lives of experienced, well-trained people. Mm. And that's exactly whom Ukraine was losing in those positions.
You're listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
911, what is your emergency?
Most towns have a local celebrity.
Who is it that's missing?
It's my dad. He went out into the water.
An eccentric known throughout the community.
Inverness market trader Kim Avis.
Kim Avis.
Kim Avis.
Inverness revolved around Kim in a way.
Difference is, the local eccentric from my hometown made international headlines.
The man's son reported he disappeared in treacherous water.
Search and rescue teams thought they had yet another drowning on their hands. Or did they?
The story's not adding up.
He is completely unhinged.
It was violent, it was controlling, it was sadistic.
Dead Man Running, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Farina Kamidi, and in this episode of The Fifth Floor, I'm joined by Vitaly Shevchenko, presenter of Ukrainecast, and Olga Ivshina from BBC Russian. So Vitaly, Russia took over Bakhmut in May 2023. What did that victory mean for Russia?
Well, there were propaganda benefits and practical benefits. In terms of propaganda, it's vitally important to sustain a high enough degree of patriotic fervor. Of course, the Kremlin media machine needs to feed the population news of victories and advances and how well things are going for Russia in Ukraine. In practical terms, it opened the way up for Russian forces to move further west.
And what is Bakhmut like these days? Are Russian forces still there?
They're still there. It's not a particularly happy place. As far as we can tell, Russians are investing certain amounts of money in rebuilding it. but after it was captured, at least that's what the Ukrainians said, pretty much, you know, a single building there escaped unscathed. Mm. Our listeners may remember that Mariupol, which is an even bigger city captured by the Russians in Donbass, they made a bit of a showcase of rebuilding it. Vladimir Putin visited it. And the message there was that, well, look, we don't only destroy, we rebuild as well. Look at the new buildings and the happy people and people moving into Mariupol from Russia. I've not seen much along those lines about Bakhmut.
And what about the population of Bakhmut, the people, the residents? What's happened to them? Where are they?
Before the war, the population of Bakhmut was about 70,000 people, and a lot of them have left, especially if you are younger, upwardly mobile. You wouldn't want to stay there as Russian forces are advancing. So who's left is either unwilling to leave because you don't really mind living under Russian occupation, or unable to live because you're ill or advanced in your years. One piece of statistic I've seen is that the population of Bakhmut at one point, it declined from 71,000 to just over 500. It's really difficult to confirm all those numbers amidst the fog of war.
Olga, after Bakhmut, things changed for the Wagner group. The leader, Prigozhin, he famously led this mutiny against Putin. And then a year ago, on August 23rd, he died in a plane crash. So what is left of the Wagner group right now, and how is it operating?
The Battle of Bakhmut costed Wagner a lot in a way. It costed Wagner its existence as an effective unit in the Russia's invasion into Ukraine. The casualties they sustained were so huge that they needed time to regroup. And while they were regrouping, yeah, Prigozhin decided to go on Moscow. After the mutiny, the Wagner unit was officially dismantled. Many of the fighters just signed up with the Russian Ministry of Defense. Some of them went to serve to Africa because despite invasion into Ukraine, Russia is still active on a number of fronts, including Africa. But now those units operating in Africa are under strict control of Russian MOD, so-called African Corps, etc. Some of those soldiers are suffering with PTSD. We read reports that some of them killed civilians, especially former criminals, and went to prisons and signed up with the Russian military again. Yeah, there are those guys who made this three times. Commit a crime, go to war, come back, commit a crime, go to war, come back.
Vicious cycle.
Yeah. And now, you know, they're heroes of war. They have all these medals. And now, according to new law, you can even skip trial. If you commit a crime, here is your contract. Off you go. I think for Russia, the legacy of Bakhmut would be very high crime rates and the absence of rule of law in Russia for many, many years, because Wagner has recruited 50,000 prisoners. 32,000 of them survived that battle, and they returned to Russia as war heroes, as people with no current convictions. So, but did their psychology change after spending months on the front line in the brutal conditions? Are they going to be nice to their families, to people around them? I doubt that. So it's decades of violence in Russia during the invasion and after the invasion.
What about you, Vitaly? What do you think will be the legacy of Bakhmut?
In terms of the people who live there, I've spoken to some of them. They're trying to get on with their lives. That arts and music college that we mentioned, it's moved to Western Ukraine, to Kamenets Podilsky. And I've spoken to these lovely, lovely people. They're busy learning music and holding concerts. But all of them that I've spoken to, they say, we want to go back. It's not looking likely, but we want to get back one day. That winery that manufactured sparkling wine, it still exists. It still makes wine, obviously not in Bakhmut. But again, I've spoken to one of their managers, and she said, I want to go back. You know, it was a lovely place, lovely people. Bakhmut is one of the locations that Ukraine has lost for now. It's been hugely damaged, destroyed, some say, and it hurts the Ukrainian soul, the Ukrainian psyche, but there's hope. There is hope.
Thank you, Vitaly Shevchenko, presenter of Ukrainecast, and Olga Ivshina from BBC Russian. If you want to find out more about the project Olga's involved with, keeping track of Russian soldiers' death toll, we put out an episode earlier this year. Just search for Russia's Lost Troops wherever you find your podcasts. And whilst you're there, don't forget to subscribe to Ukrainecast. I'm Farhanah Hamidi, and the Fifth Floor team was Ali Chedroya and Hannah Dean. You've been listening to The Documentary from the BBC World Service.
911, what is your emergency?
Most towns have a local celebrity.
Who is it that's missing?
It's my dad. He went out into the water.
An eccentric known throughout the community.
Inverness market trader Kim Avis.
Kim Avis.
Kim Avis.
Inverness revolved around Kim in a way.
Difference is, the local eccentric from my hometown made international headlines.
The man's son reported he disappeared in treacherous water.
Search and rescue teams thought they had yet another drowning on their hands. Or did they?
The story's not adding up.
He is completely unhinged.
It was violent. It was controlling. It was sadistic.
Dead Man Running, wherever you get your podcasts.